1% of its assets, compared with 0.3% for Harvard. But since the Norwegian fund is 20 times larger than Harvard's endowment, that is enough to pay for thorough investment advice. We also learn that during the period of 1970 to 2010, about 60% of the money Norway earned from petroleum was invested in the fund, while 40% a year went to government expenses. The Norwegian authorities do not tell us what their long-term objective for the fund is, or when the country can begin to consume all or part of the returns on its investment. They probably do not know themselves. Everything depends on how Norway's petroleum reserves evolve, as well as on the price of a barrel of oil and the fund's returns in the decades ahead. If we look at other sovereign wealth funds, particularly in the Middle East, we unfortunately find that they are much more opaque than the Norwegian fund. Their financial reports are frequently rather scanty. It is generally impossible to know precisely what the investment strategy is, and returns are discussed obliquely at best, with little consistency from year to year. The most recent reports published by the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, which manages the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, about the same size as Norway's, speak of a real return greater than 7% a year for 1990 to 2010, and more than 8% for 1980 to 2010. In view of the returns obtained by university endowments, these figures seem entirely plausible, but in the absence of detailed annual information, it is difficult to say more. It is interesting to note that different funds apparently follow very different investment strategies, which are related, moreover, to very different ways of communicating with the public and very different approaches to global politics. Abu Dhabi is outspoken about its fund's high returns, but Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, which ranks third after Abu Dhabi and Norway among sovereign wealth funds of petroleum-exporting states and ahead of Kuwait, Qatar, and Russia, has chosen to keep a very low profile. The small petroleum states of the Persian Gulf, which have only tiny populations to worry about, are clearly addressing the international financial community as the primary audience for their reports. The Saudi reports are more sober and provide information not only about oil reserves, but also about national accounts and the government budget. These are clearly addressed to the people of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, whose population was close to 20 million in 2010. Still small compared to the large countries in the region, Iran, 80 million, Egypt, 85 million, Iraq, 35 million, but far larger than the microstates of the Gulf. And that is not the only difference. Saudi funds seem to be invested much less aggressively. According to official documents, the average return on the Saudi sovereign wealth fund was no more than 2 to 3%, mainly because much of the money was invested in U.S. Treasury bonds. Saudi financial reports do not come close to providing enough information to know how the portfolio has evolved, but the information they do provide is much more detailed than that provided by the Emirates, and on this specific point, they seem to be accurate. Why would Saudi Arabia choose to invest in U.S. Treasury bonds when it is possible to get far better returns elsewhere? The question is worth asking, especially since U.S. university endowments stopped investing in their own government's debt decades ago and roamed the world in search of the best return, investing in hedge funds, unlisted shares, and commodities-based derivatives. To be sure, U.S. treasuries offer an enviable guarantee of stability in an unstable world, and it is possible that the Saudi public has little taste for alternative investments. But the political and military aspects of the choice must also be taken into account. Even though it is never stated explicitly, it is not illogical for Saudi Arabia to lend at low interest to the country that protects it militarily. To my knowledge, no one has ever attempted to calculate precisely the return on such an investment, but it seems clear that it is rather high. If the United States, backed by other Western powers, had not driven the Iraqi army out of Kuwait in 1991, Iraq would probably have threatened Saudi Arabia's oil fields next, and it is possible that other countries in the region, such as Iran, would have joined the fray to redistribute the region's petroleum rents. The dynamics of the global distribution of capital are at once economic, political, and military. This was already the case in the colonial era, when the great powers of the day, Britain and France foremost among them, were quick to roll out the cannon to protect their investments. Clearly, the same will be true in the 21st century, in a tense new global political configuration whose contours are difficult to predict in advance. Will sovereign wealth funds own the world? How much richer can the sovereign wealth funds become in the decades ahead? According to available and notoriously imperfect estimates, sovereign wealth funds in 2013 had total investments worth a little over $5.3 trillion, of which about $3.2 trillion belongs to the funds of petroleum exporting states, including, in addition to those mentioned above, the smaller funds of Dubai, Libya, Kazakhstan, Algeria, Iran, Azerbaijan, Brunei, Oman, and many others, and approximately $2.1 trillion to funds of non-petroleum states, primarily China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and many smaller funds. For reference, note that this is almost exactly the same total wealth as that represented by the Forbes billionaires, around $5.4 trillion in 2013. In other words, billionaires today own roughly 1.5% of the world's total private wealth, and sovereign wealth funds own another 1.5%. It is perhaps reassuring to note that this leaves 97% of global capital for the rest. One can also do projections for the sovereign wealth funds, just as I did for billionaires, from which it follows that they will not achieve decisive importance, 10 to 20% of global capital, before the second half of the 21st century, and we are still a long way from having to pay our monthly rent to the Emir of Qatar or the taxpayers of Norway. Nevertheless, it would still be a mistake to ignore the issue. In the first place, there is no reason why we should not worry about the rents our children and grandchildren may have to pay, and we need not wait until things come to a head to think about what to do. Second, a substantial part of global capital is in relatively illiquid form, including real estate and business capital that cannot be traded on financial markets, so that the share of truly liquid capital owned by sovereign wealth funds, and to a lesser extent billionaires, capital that can be used, say, to take over a bankrupt company, buy a football team, or invest in a decaying neighborhood when strapped governments lack the means to do so, is actually much higher. In fact, the issue of investments originating in the petroleum exporting countries has become increasingly salient in the wealthy countries, especially France. And as noted, these are perhaps the countries least psychologically prepared for the comeback of capital. Last but not least, the key difference between the sovereign wealth funds and the billionaires is that the funds, or at any rate those of the petroleum exporting countries, grow not only by reinvesting their returns, but also by investing part of the proceeds of oil sales. Although the future amounts of such proceeds are highly uncertain, owing to uncertainties about the amount of oil still in the ground, the demand for oil, and the price per barrel, it is quite plausible to assume that this income from petroleum sales will largely outweigh the returns on existing investments. The annual rent derived from the exploitation of natural resources, defined as the difference between receipts from sales and the cost of production, has been about 5% of global GDP since the mid-2000s, half of which is petroleum rent, and the rest rent on other natural resources, mainly gas, coal, minerals, and wood, compared with about 2% in the 1990s and less than 1% in the early 1970s. According to some forecasting models, the price of petroleum, currently around $100 a barrel, compared with $25 in the early 2000s, could rise as high as $200 a barrel by 2020 to 2030. If a sufficiently large fraction of the corresponding rent is invested in sovereign wealth funds every year, a fraction that should be considerably larger than it is today, one can imagine a scenario in which the sovereign wealth funds would own 10 to 20% or more of global capital by 2030 to 2040. No law of economics rules this out. Everything depends on supply and demand, on whether or not new oil deposits and/or sources of energy are discovered, and on how rapidly people learn to live without petroleum. In any event, it is almost inevitable that the sovereign wealth funds of the petroleum-exporting countries will continue to grow, and that their share of global assets in 2030 to 2040 will be at least 2 to 3 times greater than it is today, a significant increase. If this happens, it is likely that the Western countries would find it increasingly difficult to accept the idea of being owned in substantial part by the sovereign wealth funds of the oil states, and sooner or later this would trigger political reactions, such as restrictions on the purchase of real estate and industrial and financial assets by sovereign wealth funds, or even partial or total expropriations. Such a reaction would neither be terribly smart politically, nor especially effective economically. But it is the kind of response that is within the power of national governments, even of smaller states. Note, moreover, that the petroleum-exporting countries themselves have already begun to limit their foreign investments and have begun investing heavily in their own countries to build museums, hotels, universities, and even ski slopes, at times on a scale that seems devoid of economic and financial rationality. It may be that this behavior reflects awareness of the fact that it is harder to expropriate an investment made at home than one made abroad. There is no guarantee, however, that the process will always be peaceful. No one knows the precise location of the psychological and political boundaries that must not be crossed when it comes to the ownership of one country by another. Will China own the world? The sovereign wealth funds of non-petroleum exporting countries raise a different kind of problem. Why would a country with no particular natural resources to speak of decide to own another country? One possibility is, of course, neo-colonial ambitions, a pure will to power, as in the era of European colonialism. But the difference is that in those days, the European countries enjoyed a technological advantage that ensured their domination. China and other emerging non-petroleum countries are growing very rapidly, to be sure, but the evidence suggests that this rapid growth will end once they catch up with the leaders in terms of productivity and standard of living. The diffusion of knowledge and productive technologies is a fundamentally equalizing process. Once the less advanced countries catch up with the more advanced, they cease to grow more rapidly. In the central scenario for the evolution of the global capital-income ratio that I discussed in Chapter 5, I assumed that the savings rate would stabilize at around 10% of national income, as this international convergence process neared its end. In that case, the accumulation of capital would attain comparable proportions everywhere. A very large share of the world's capital stock would, of course, be accumulated in Asia, and especially China, in keeping with the region's future share of global output. But according to the central scenario, the capital-income ratio would be the same on all continents, so that there would be no major imbalance between savings and investment in any region. Africa would be the only exception. In the central scenario depicted in PDF figures 12.4 and 12.5, the capital-income ratio is expected to be lower in Africa than in other continents throughout the 21st century, essentially because Africa is catching up economically much more slowly and its demographic transition is also delayed. If capital can flow freely across borders, one would expect to see a flow of investments in Africa from other countries, especially China and other Asian nations. For the reasons discussed above, this could give rise to serious tensions, signs of which are already visible. To be sure, one can easily imagine scenarios much more unbalanced than the central scenario. Nevertheless, the forces of divergence are much less obvious than in the case of the sovereign wealth funds, whose growth depends on windfalls totally disproportionate to the needs of the populations benefiting from them, especially where those populations are tiny. This leads to endless accumulation, which the inequality R is greater than G transforms into a permanent divergence in the global capital distribution. To sum up, petroleum rents might well enable the oil states to buy the rest of the planet, or much of it, and to live on the rents of their accumulated capital. China, India, and other emerging countries are different. These countries have large populations whose needs, for both consumption and investment, remain far from satisfied. One can, of course, imagine scenarios in which the Chinese savings rate would remain persistently above the savings rate in Europe or North America. For example, China might choose a retirement system funded by investments rather than a pay-as-you-go system, a rather tempting choice in a low-growth environment, and even more tempting if demographic growth is negative. For example, if China saves 20% of its national income until 2100, while Europe and the United States save only 10%, then by 2100, a large part of the old and new worlds will be owned by enormous Chinese pension funds. Although this is logically possible, it is not very plausible, in part because Chinese workers and Chinese society as a whole would no doubt prefer, not without reason, to rely in large part on a public partition system for their retirement, as in Europe and the United States, and in part because of the political considerations already noted in the case of the petroleum exporting countries and their sovereign wealth funds, which would apply with equal force to Chinese pension funds. International divergence, oligarchic divergence. In any case, this threat of international divergence, owing to a gradual acquisition of the rich countries by China, or by the petroleum exporters' sovereign wealth funds, seems less credible and dangerous than an oligarchic type of divergence. That is, a process in which the rich countries would come to be owned by their own billionaires, or, more generally, in which all countries, including China and the petroleum exporters, would come to be owned more and more by the planet's billionaires and multimillionaires. As noted, this process is already well underway. As global growth slows and international competition for capital heats up, there is every reason to believe that R will be much greater than G in the decades ahead. If we add to this the fact that the return on capital increases with the size of the initial endowment, a phenomenon that may well be reinforced by the growing complexity of global financial markets, then clearly all the ingredients are in place for the top centile and thousandth of the global wealth distribution to pull farther and farther ahead of the rest. To be sure, it is quite difficult to foresee how rapidly this oligarchic divergence will occur, but the risk seems much greater than the risk of international divergence. In particular, it is important to stress that the currently prevalent fears of growing Chinese ownership are a pure fantasy. The wealthy countries are in fact much wealthier than they sometimes think. The total real estate and financial assets, net of debt, owned by European households today amount to some 70 trillion euros. By comparison, the total assets of the various Chinese sovereign wealth funds, plus the reserves of the Bank of China, represent around 3 trillion euros, or less than 1/20 the former amount. The rich countries are not about to be taken over by the poor countries, which would have to get much richer to do anything of the kind, and that will take many more decades. What then is the source of this fear, this feeling of dispossession, which is partly irrational? Part of the reason is no doubt the universal tendency to look elsewhere for the source of domestic difficulties. For example, many people in France believe that rich foreign buyers are responsible for the skyrocketing price of Paris real estate. When one looks closely at who is buying what type of apartment, however, one finds that the increase in the number of foreign, or foreign resident, buyers can explain barely 3% of the price increase. In other words, 97% of today's very high real estate prices are due to the fact that there are enough French buyers residing in France who are prosperous enough to pay such large amounts for property. To my mind, this feeling of dispossession is due primarily to the fact that wealth is very highly concentrated in the rich countries, so that for much of the population, capital is an abstraction, and the process of the political secession of the largest fortunes is already well underway. For most people living in the wealthy countries, of Europe especially, the idea that European households own 20 times as much capital as China is rather hard to grasp, especially since this wealth is private and cannot be mobilized by governments for public purposes, such as aiding Greece, as China helpfully proposed not long ago. Yet this private European wealth is very real, and if the governments of the European Union decided to tap it, they could. But the fact is that it is very difficult for any single government to regulate or tax capital and the income it generates. The main reason for the feeling of dispossession that grips the rich countries today is this loss of democratic sovereignty. This is especially true in Europe, whose territory is carved up into small states in competition with one another for capital, which aggravates the whole process. The very substantial increase in gross foreign asset positions, with each country owning a larger and larger stake in its neighbors, as discussed in Chapter 5, is also part of this process and contributes to the sense of helplessness. In Part 4, I will show how useful a tool a global, or if need be European, tax on capital would be for overcoming these contradictions, and I will also consider what other government responses might be possible. To be clear, oligarchic divergence is not only more probable than international divergence, it is also much more difficult to combat, because it demands a high degree of international coordination among countries that are ordinarily engaged in competition with one another. The secession of wealth tends, moreover, to obscure the very idea of nationality, since the wealthiest individuals can, to some extent, take their money and change their nationality, cutting all ties to their original community. Only a coordinated response at a relatively broad regional level can overcome this difficulty. Are the rich countries really poor? Another point that needs to be emphasized is that a substantial fraction of global financial assets is already hidden away in various tax havens, thus limiting our ability to analyze the geographic distribution of global wealth. To judge by official statistics alone, relying on national data collated by international organizations, such as the IMF, it would seem that the net asset position of the wealthy countries vis-à-vis the rest of the world is negative. As noted in Part 2, Japan and Germany are in substantial surplus relative to the rest of the world, meaning that their households, firms, and governments own a lot more foreign assets than the rest of the world owns of their assets, which reflects the fact that they have been running large trade surpluses in recent decades. But the net position of the United States is negative, and that of most European countries, other than Germany, is close to zero, if not in the red. All told, when one adds up the positions of all the wealthy countries, one is left with a slightly negative position, equivalent to about -4% of global GDP in 2010, compared with close to zero in the mid-1980s, as PDF figure 12.6 shows. It is important to recognize, however, that it is a very slightly negative position, amounting to just 1% of global wealth. In any case, as I have already discussed at length, we are living in a time when international positions are relatively balanced, at least when compared with the colonial period, when the rich countries enjoyed a much larger positive position with respect to the rest of the world. Of course, this slightly negative official position should in principle be counterbalanced by an equivalent positive position for the rest of the world. In other words, the poorer countries should own more assets in the rich countries than vice versa, with a surplus on the order of 4% of global GDP, or 1% of global wealth in their favor. In fact, this is not the case. If one adds up the financial statistics for the various countries of the world, one finds that the poor countries also have a negative position, and that the world as a whole is in a substantially negative situation. It seems, in other words, that Earth must be owned by Mars. This is a fairly odd statistical anomaly, but according to various international organizations, it has gotten worse in recent years. The global balance of payments is regularly negative. More money leaves countries than enters them, which is theoretically impossible. No real explanation of this phenomenon has been forthcoming. Note that these financial statistics and balance of payments data in theory cover the entire world. In particular, banks in the tax havens are theoretically required to report their accounts to international institutions. The anomaly can presumably be explained by various statistical biases and measurement errors. By comparing all the available sources and exploiting previously unused Swiss bank data, Gabriel Zucman was able to show that the most plausible reason for the discrepancy is that large amounts of unreported financial assets are held in tax havens. By his cautious estimate, these amount to nearly 10% of global GDP. Certain non-governmental organizations have proposed even larger estimates, up to 2 or 3 times larger. Given the current state of the available sources, I believe that Zucman's estimate is slightly more realistic, but such estimates are by nature uncertain, and it is possible that Zucman's is a lower bound. In any event, the important fact is that this lower bound is already extremely high. In particular, it is more than twice as large as the official negative net position of the combined rich countries. See PDF Figure 12.6. Now, all the evidence indicates that the vast majority, at least three-quarters, of the financial assets held in tax havens belongs to residents of the rich countries. The conclusion is obvious. The net asset position of the rich countries, relative to the rest of the world, is in fact positive. The rich countries own, on average, more than the poor countries, and not vice versa, which ultimately is not very surprising. But this is masked by the fact that the wealthiest residents of the rich countries are hiding some of their assets in tax havens. In particular, this implies that the very sharp increase in private wealth, relative to national income, in the rich countries in recent decades is actually even larger than we estimated on the basis of official accounts. The same is true of the upward trend of the share of large fortunes in total wealth. Indeed, this shows how difficult it is to track assets in the globalized capitalism of the early 21st century, thus blurring our picture of the basic geography of wealth. Part 4. Regulating Capital in the 21st Century. Chapter 13. A Social State for the 21st Century. In the first three parts of this book, I analyzed the evolution of the distribution of wealth and the structure of inequality since the 18th century. From this analysis, I must now try to draw lessons for the future. One major lesson is already clear. It was the wars of the 20th century that, to a large extent, wiped away the past and transformed the structure of inequality. Today, in the second decade of the 21st century, inequalities of wealth that had supposedly disappeared are close to regaining or even surpassing their historical highs. The new global economy has brought with it both immense hopes, such as the eradication of poverty, and equally immense inequities. Some individuals are now as wealthy as entire countries. Can we imagine a 21st century in which capitalism will be transcended in a more peaceful and more lasting way? Or must we simply await the next crisis, or the next war, this time truly global? On the basis of the history I have brought to light here, can we imagine political institutions that might regulate today's global patrimonial capitalism justly, as well as efficiently? As I have already noted, the ideal policy for avoiding an endless inegalitarian spiral and regaining control over the dynamics of accumulation would be a progressive global tax on capital. Such a tax would also have another virtue. It would expose wealth to democratic scrutiny, which is a necessary condition for effective regulation of the banking system and international capital flows. A tax on capital would promote the general interest over private interests, while preserving economic openness and the forces of competition. The same cannot be said of various forms of retreat into national or other identities, which may well be the alternative to this ideal policy. But a truly global tax on capital is no doubt a utopian ideal. Short of that, a regional or continental tax might be tried, in particular in Europe, starting with countries willing to accept such a tax. Before I come to that, I must first re-examine in a much broader context the question of a tax on capital, which is, of course, only one component of an ideal social and fiscal system. What is the role of government in the production and distribution of wealth in the 21st century, and what kind of social state is most suitable for the age? The crisis of 2008 and the return of the state. The global financial crisis that began in 2007 to 2008 is generally described as the most serious crisis of capitalism since the crash of 1929. The comparison is in some ways justified, but essential differences remain. The most obvious of these is that the recent crisis has not led to a depression as devastating as the Great Depression of the 1930s. Between 1929 and 1935, production in the developed countries fell by a quarter, unemployment rose by the same amount, and the world did not entirely recover from the depression until the onset of World War II. Fortunately, the current crisis has been significantly less cataclysmic. That is why it has been given a less alarming name, the Great Recession. To be sure, the leading developed economies in 2013 are not quite back to the level of output they had achieved in 2007. Government finances are in pitiful condition, and prospects for growth look gloomy for the foreseeable future, especially in Europe, which is mired in an endless sovereign debt crisis, which is ironic since Europe is also the continent with the highest capital income ratio in the world. Yet even in the depths of the recession, in 2009, production did not fall by more than 5 percentage points in the wealthiest countries. This was enough to make it the most serious global recession since the end of World War II, but it is still a very different thing from the dramatic collapse of output and waves of bankruptcies of the 1930s. Furthermore, growth in the emerging countries quickly bounced back and is buoying global growth today. The main reason why the crisis of 2008 did not trigger a crash as serious as the Great Depression is that this time the governments and central banks of the wealthy countries did not allow the financial system to collapse and agreed to create the liquidity necessary to avoid the waves of bank failures that led the world to the brink of the abyss in the 1930s. This pragmatic monetary and financial policy poles apart from the liquidationist orthodoxy that reigned nearly everywhere after the 1929 crash, managed to avoid the worst. Herbert Hoover, the U.S. president in 1929, thought that limping businesses had to be liquidated. And until Franklin Roosevelt replaced Hoover in 1933, they were. The pragmatic response to the crisis also reminded the world that central banks do not exist just to twiddle their thumbs and keep down inflation. In situations of total financial panic, they play an indispensable role as lender of last resort. Indeed, they are the only public institution capable of averting a total collapse of the economy and society in an emergency. That said, central banks are not designed to solve all the world's problems. The pragmatic policies adopted after the crisis of 2008 no doubt avoided the worst, but they did not really provide a durable response to the structural problems that made the crisis possible, including the crying lack of financial transparency and the rise of inequality. The crisis of 2008 was the first crisis of the globalized patrimonial capitalism of the 21st century. It is unlikely to be the last. Many observers deplore the absence of any real return of the state to managing the economy. They point out that the Great Depression, as terrible as it was, at least deserves credit for bringing about radical changes in tax policy and government spending. Indeed, within a few years of his inauguration, Roosevelt increased the top marginal rate of the federal income tax to more than 80% on extremely high incomes, whereas the top rate under Hoover had been only 25%. By contrast, at the time of this writing, Washington is still wondering whether the Obama administration will be able in its second term to raise the top rate left by Bush, of around 35%, above what it was under Clinton in the 1990s, around 40%. In Chapter 14, I will look at the question of confiscatory tax rates on incomes deemed to be indecent and economically useless, which was in fact an impressive U.S. innovation of the interwar years. To my mind, it deserves to be reconceived and revived, especially in the country that first thought of it. To be sure, good economic and social policy requires more than just a high marginal tax rate on extremely high incomes. By its very nature, such a tax brings in almost nothing. A progressive tax on capital is a more suitable instrument for responding to the challenges of the 21st century than a progressive income tax, which was designed for the 20th century, although the two tools can play complementary roles in the future. For now, however, it is important to dispel a possible misunderstanding. The possibility of greater state intervention in the economy raises very different issues today than it did in the 1930s, for a simple reason. The influence of the state is much greater now than it was then. Indeed, in many ways greater than it has ever been. That is why today's crisis is both an indictment of the markets and a challenge to the role of government. Of course, the role of government has been constantly challenged since the 1970s, and the challenges will never end. Once the government takes on the central role in economic and social life that it acquired in the decades after World War II, it is normal and legitimate for that role to be permanently questioned and debated. To some, this may seem unjust, but it is inevitable and natural. Some people are baffled by the new role of government, and vehement if uncomprehending clashes between apparently irreconcilable positions are not uncommon. Some are outspoken in favor of an even greater role for the state, as if it no longer played any role at all, while still others call for the state to be dismantled at once, especially in the country where it is least present, the United States. There, groups affiliated with the Tea Party call for abolishing the Federal Reserve and returning to the gold standard. In Europe, the verbal clashes between lazy Greeks and Nazi Germans can be even more vitriolic. None of this helps to solve the real problems at hand. Both the anti-market and anti-state camps are partly correct. New instruments are needed to regain control over a financial capitalism that has run amok. And at the same time, the tax and transfer systems that are the heart of the modern social state are in constant need of reform and modernization, because they have achieved a level of complexity that makes them difficult to understand and threatens to undermine their social and economic efficacy. This twofold task may seem insurmountable. It is, in fact, an enormous challenge, which our democratic societies will have to meet in the years ahead. But it will be impossible to convince a majority of citizens that our governing institutions, especially at the supranational level, need new tools unless the instruments already in place can be shown to be working properly. To clarify all this, I must first take a look backward and briefly discuss how taxation and government spending have evolved in the rich countries since the 19th century. The growth of the social state in the 20th century. The simplest way to measure the change in the government's role in the economy and society is to look at the total amount of taxes relative to national income. PDF figure 13.1 shows the historical trajectory of four countries, the United States, Britain, France, and Sweden, that are fairly representative of what has happened in the rich countries. There are both striking similarities and important differences in the observed evolutions. The first similarity is that taxes consumed less than 10% of national income in all four countries during the 19th century and up to World War I. This reflects the fact that the state at that time had very little involvement in economic and social life. With 7 to 8% of national income, it is possible for a government to fulfill its central regalian functions: police, courts, army, foreign affairs, general administration, etc. But not much more. After paying to maintain order, enforce property rights, and sustain the military, which often accounts for more than half of total expenditures, not much remained in the government's coffers. States in this period also paid for some roads and other infrastructure, as well as schools, universities, and hospitals, but most people had access only to fairly rudimentary educational and health services. Between 1920 and 1980, the share of national income that the wealthy countries chose to devote to social spending increased considerably. In just half a century, the share of taxes in national income increased by a factor of at least 3 or 4, and in the Nordic countries, more than 5. Between 1980 and 2010, however, the tax share stabilized everywhere. This stabilization took place at different levels in each country. However, just over 30% of national income in the United States, around 40% in Britain, and between 45 and 55% on the European continent, 45% in Germany, 50% in France, and nearly 55% in Sweden. The differences between countries are significant. Nevertheless, the secular evolutions are closely matched, in particular the almost perfect stability observed in all four countries over the past 3 decades. Political changes and national peculiarities are also noticeable in PDF Figure 13.1, between Britain and France, for example. But their importance is on the whole rather limited compared with this common stabilization. In other words, all the rich countries, without exception, went in the 20th century from an equilibrium in which less than a tenth of their national income was consumed by taxes to a new equilibrium, in which the figure rose to between a third and a half. Several important points about this fundamental transformation call for further clarification. First, it should be clear why the question of whether or not there has been a return to the state in the present crisis is misleading. The role of the government is greater than ever. In order to fully appreciate the state's role in economic and social life, other indicators, of course, need to be considered. The state also intervenes by setting rules, not just by collecting taxes to pay its expenses. For example, the financial markets were much less tightly regulated after 1980 than before. The state also produces and owns capital. Privatization of formerly state-owned industrial and financial assets over the past 3 decades has also reduced the state's role in comparison with the 3 decades after World War II. Nevertheless, in terms of tax receipts and government outlays, the state has never played as important an economic role as it has in recent decades. No downward trend is evident, contrary to what is sometimes said. To be sure, in the face of an aging population, advances in medical technology, and constantly growing educational needs, the mere fact of having stabilized the tax bill as a percentage of national income is in itself no mean feat. Cutting the government budget is always easier to promise in opposition than to achieve once in power. Nevertheless, the fact remains that taxes today claim nearly half of national income in most European countries, and no one seriously envisions an increase in the future comparable to that which occurred between 1930 and 1980. In the wake of the Depression, World War II, and post-war Reconstruction, it was reasonable to think that the solution to the problems of capitalism was to expand the role of the state and increase social spending as much as necessary. Today's choices are necessarily more complex. The state's great leap forward has already taken place. There will be no second leap. Not like the first one, in any event. To gain a better understanding of what is at stake behind these figures, I want to describe in somewhat greater detail what this historic increase in government tax revenues was used for: the construction of a social state. In the 19th century, governments were content to fulfill their regalian missions. Today, these same functions command a little less than one-tenth of national income. The growing tax bite enabled governments to take on ever broader social functions, which now consume between a quarter and a third of national income, depending on the country. This can be broken down initially into two roughly equal halves. One half goes to health and education, the other to replacement incomes and transfer payments. Spending on education and health consumes 10 to 15% of national income in all the developed countries today. There are significant differences between countries, however. Primary and secondary education are almost entirely free for everyone in all the rich countries. But higher education can be quite expensive, especially in the United States, and to a lesser extent in Britain. Public health insurance is universal, that is, open to the entire population in most countries in Europe, including Britain. In the United States, however, it is reserved for the poor and elderly, which does not prevent it from being very costly. In all the developed countries, public spending covers much of the cost of education and health services, about three-quarters in Europe and half in the United States. The goal is to give equal access to these basic goods. Every child should have access to education, regardless of his or her parents' income, and everyone should have access to health care, even, indeed especially, when circumstances are difficult. Replacement incomes and transfer payments generally consume 10 to 15, or even 20% of national income in most of the rich countries today. Unlike public spending on education and health, which may be regarded as transfers in kind, replacement income and transfer payments form part of household disposable income. The government takes in large sums in taxes and social insurance contributions, and then pays them out to other households in the form of replacement income, pensions, and unemployment compensation, and transfer payments, family allowances, guaranteed income, etc., so that the total disposable income of all households in the aggregate remains unchanged. In practice, pensions account for the lion's share, two-thirds to three-quarters of total replacement income and transfer payments. Here, too, there are significant differences between countries. In continental Europe, pensions alone often consume 12 to 13% of national income, with Italy and France at the top, ahead of Germany and Sweden. In the United States and Britain, the public pension system is much more drastically capped for those at the middle and top of the income hierarchy. The replacement rate, that is, the amount of the pension in proportion to the wage earned prior to retirement, falls rather quickly for those who earned above the average wage, and pensions consume only 6 to 7% of national income. These are very large sums in all cases. In all the rich countries, public pensions are the main source of income for at least two-thirds of retirees, and generally three-quarters. Despite the defects of these public pensions systems and the challenges they now face, the fact is that without them, it would have been impossible to eradicate poverty among the elderly, which was endemic as recently as the 1950s. Along with access to education and health, public pensions constitute the third social revolution that the fiscal revolution of the 20th century made possible. Compared with pension outlays, payments for unemployment insurance are much smaller, typically 1 to 2% of national income, reflecting the fact that people spend less time in unemployment than in retirement. The replacement income is nevertheless useful when needed. Finally, income support outlays are even smaller, less than 1% of national income, almost insignificant when measured against total government spending. Yet, this type of spending is often the most vigorously challenged. Beneficiaries are suspected of wanting to live their lives on the dole, even though the proportion of the population relying on welfare payments is generally far smaller than for other government programs, because the stigma attached to welfare, and in many cases the complexity of the process, dissuades many who are entitled to benefits from asking for them. Welfare benefits are questioned not only in Europe, but also in the United States, where the unemployed black single mother is often singled out for criticism by opponents of the U.S. welfare state. In both cases, the sums involved are in fact only a very small part of state social spending. All told, if we add up state spending on health and education, 10 to 15% of national income, and replacement and transfer payments, another 10 to 15% or perhaps as high as 20% of national income, we come up with total social spending, broadly speaking, of 25 to 35% of national income, which accounts for nearly all of the increase in government revenues in the wealthy countries in the 20th century. In other words, the growth of the fiscal state over the last century basically reflects the constitution of a social state. Modern redistribution, a logic of rights. To sum up, modern redistribution does not consist in transferring income from the rich to the poor, at least not in so explicit a way. It consists rather in financing public services and replacement incomes that are more or less equal for everyone, especially in the areas of health, education, and pensions. In the latter case, the principle of equality often takes the form of a quasi-proportionality between replacement income and lifetime earnings. For education and health, there is real equality of access for everyone, regardless of income or parents' income, at least in principle. Modern redistribution is built around a logic of rights and a principle of equal access to a certain number of goods deemed to be fundamental. At a relatively abstract level, it is possible to find justifications for this rights-based approach in various national political and philosophical traditions. The U.S. Declaration of Independence, 1776, asserts that everyone has an equal right to the pursuit of happiness. In a sense, our modern belief in fundamental rights to education and health can be linked to this assertion, even though it took quite a while to get there. Article 1 of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, 1789, also proclaims that men are born free and remain free and equal in rights. This is followed immediately, however, by the statement that social distinctions can be based only on common utility. This is an important addition. The second sentence alludes to the existence of very real inequalities, even though the first asserts the principle of absolute equality. Indeed, this is the central tension of any rights-based approach. How far do equal rights extend? Do they simply guarantee the right to enter into free contract, the equality of the market, which at the time of the French Revolution actually seemed quite revolutionary? And if one includes equal rights to an education, to health care, and to a pension, as the 20th century social state proposed, should one also include rights to culture, housing, and travel? The second sentence of Article 1 of the Declaration of the Rights of Man of 1789 formulates a kind of answer to this question. Since it, in a sense, reverses the burden of proof, equality is the norm, and inequality is acceptable only if based on common utility. It remains to define the term common utility. The drafters of the Declaration were thinking mainly of the abolition of the orders and privileges of the Ancien Régime, which were seen at the time as the very epitome of arbitrary, useless inequality, hence as not contributing to common utility. One can interpret the phrase more broadly, however. One reasonable interpretation is that social inequalities are acceptable only if they are in the interest of all, and in particular of the most disadvantaged social groups. Hence, basic rights and material advantages must be extended insofar as possible to everyone, as long as it is in the interest of those who have the fewest rights and opportunities to do so. The difference principle, introduced by the U.S. philosopher John Rawls in his Theory of Justice, is similar in intent. And the capabilities approach, favored by the Indian economist Amartya Sen, is not very different in its basic logic. At a purely theoretical level, there is in fact a certain, partly artificial consensus concerning the abstract principles of social justice. The disagreements become clearer when one tries to give a little substance to these social rights and inequalities, and to anchor them in specific historical and economic contexts. In practice, the conflicts have to do mainly with the means of effecting real improvement in the living conditions of the least advantaged. The precise extent of the rights that can be granted to all, in view of economic and budgetary constraints and the many related uncertainties, and exactly what factors are within and beyond the control of individuals. Where does luck end, and where do effort and merit begin? Such questions will never be answered by abstract principles or mathematical formulas. The only way to answer them is through democratic deliberation and political confrontation. The institutions and rules that govern democratic debate and decision-making therefore play a central role, as do the relative power and persuasive capabilities of different social groups. The U.S. and French revolutions both affirmed equality of rights as an absolute principle, a progressive stance at that time. But in practice, during the 19th century, the political systems that grew out of those revolutions concentrated mainly on the protection of property rights. Modernizing rather than dismantling the social state. Modern redistribution, as exemplified by the social states constructed by the wealthy countries in the 20th century, is based on a set of fundamental social rights to education, health, and retirement. Whatever limitations and challenges these systems of taxation and social spending face today, they nevertheless marked an immense step forward in historical terms. Partisan conflict aside, a broad consensus has formed around these social systems, particularly in Europe, which remains deeply attached to what is seen as a European social model. No major movement or important political force seriously envisions a return to a world in which only 10 or 20% of national income would go to taxes and government would be pared down to its regalian functions. On the other hand, there is no significant support for continuing to expand the social state at its 1930 to 1980 growth rate, which would mean that by 2050 to 2060, 70 to 80% of national income would go to taxes. In theory, of course, there is no reason why a country cannot decide to devote two-thirds or three-quarters of its national income to taxes, assuming that taxes are collected in a transparent and efficient manner and used for purposes that everyone agrees are of high priority, such as education, health, culture, clean energy, and sustainable development. Taxation is neither good nor bad in itself. Everything depends on how taxes are collected and what they are used for. There are nevertheless two good reasons to believe that such a drastic increase in the size of the social state is neither realistic nor desirable, at least for the foreseeable future. First, the very rapid expansion of the role of government in the three decades after World War II was greatly facilitated and accelerated by exceptionally rapid economic growth, at least in continental Europe. When incomes are increasing 5% a year, it is not too difficult to get people to agree to devote an increasing share of that growth to social spending, which therefore increases more rapidly than the economy, especially when the need for better education, more health care, and more generous pensions is obvious, given the very limited funds allocated for these purposes from 1930 to 1950. The situation has been very different since the 1980s. With per capita income growth of just over 1% a year, no one wants large and steady tax increases, which would mean even slower, if not negative, income growth. Of course, it is possible to imagine a redistribution of income via the tax system, or more progressive tax rates applied to a more or less stable total income. But it is very difficult to imagine a general and durable increase in the average tax rate. The fact that tax revenues have stabilized in all the rich countries, notwithstanding national differences and changes of government, is no accident. See PDF Figure 13.1. Furthermore, it is by no means certain that social needs justify ongoing tax increases. To be sure, there are objectively growing needs in the educational and health spheres, which may well justify slight tax increases in the future. But the citizens of the wealthy countries also have a legitimate need for enough income to purchase all sorts of goods and services produced by the private sector. For instance, to travel, buy clothing, obtain housing, avail themselves of new cultural services, purchase the latest tablet, and so on. In a world of low productivity growth, on the order of 1 to 1.5%, which is in fact a decent rate of growth over the long term, society has to choose among different types of needs, and there is no obvious reason to think that nearly all needs should be paid for through taxation. Furthermore, no matter how the proceeds of growth are allocated among different needs, there remains the fact that once the public sector grows beyond a certain size, it must contend with serious problems of organization. Once again, it is hard to foresee what will happen in the very long run. It is perfectly possible to imagine that new decentralized and participatory forms of organization will be developed, along with innovative types of governance, so that a much larger public sector than exists today can be operated efficiently. The very notion of public sector is in any case reductive. The fact that a service is publicly financed does not mean that it is produced by people directly employed by the state or other public entities. In education and health, services are provided by many kinds of organizations, including foundations and associations, which are in fact intermediate forms between the state and private enterprise. All told, education and health account for 20% of employment and GDP in the developed economies, which is more than all sectors of industry combined. This way of organizing production is durable and universal. For example, no one has proposed transforming private U.S. universities into publicly owned corporations. It is perfectly possible that such intermediary forms will become more common in the future, for example, in the cultural and media sectors, where profit-making corporations already face serious competition and raise concerns about potential conflicts of interest. As I showed earlier when discussing how capitalism is organized in Germany, the notion of private property can vary from country to country, even in the automobile business, one of the most traditional branches of industry. There is no single variety of capitalism or organization of production in the developed world today. We live in a mixed economy, different, to be sure, from the mixed economy that people envisioned after World War II, but nonetheless quite real. This will continue to be true in the future, no doubt more than ever. New forms of organization and ownership remain to be invented. That said, before we can learn to efficiently organize public financing equivalent to 2/3 to 3/4 of national income, it would be good to improve the organization and operation of the existing public sector, which represents only half of national income, including replacement and transfer payments. No small affair. In Germany, France, Italy, Britain, and Sweden, debates about the social state in the decades to come will revolve mainly around issues of organization, modernization, and consolidation. If total taxes and social spending remain more or less unchanged in proportion to national income, or perhaps rise slightly in response to growing needs, how can we improve the operation of hospitals and daycare centers, adjust doctors' fees and drug costs, reform universities and primary schools, and revise pension and unemployment benefits in response to changing life expectancies and youth unemployment rates? At a time when nearly half of national income goes to public spending, such debates are legitimate and even indispensable. If we do not constantly ask how to adapt our social services to the public's needs, the consensus supporting high levels of taxation, and therefore the social state, may not last forever. Obviously, an analysis of the prospects for reform of all aspects of the social state would far exceed the scope of this book. I will therefore confine myself to a few issues of particular importance for the future and directly related to the themes of my work. First, the question of equal access to education, and especially higher education, and second, the future of pay-as-you-go retirement systems in a world of low growth. Do educational institutions foster social mobility? In all countries, on all continents, One of the main objectives of public spending for education is to promote social mobility. The stated goal is to provide access to education for everyone, regardless of social origin. To what extent do existing institutions fulfill this objective? In Part 3, I showed that even with the considerable increase in the average level of education over the course of the 20th century, earned income inequality did not decrease. Qualification levels shifted upward. A high school diploma now represents what a grade school certificate used to mean, a college degree what a high school diploma used to stand for, and so on. As technologies and workplace needs changed, all wage levels increased at similar rates, so that inequality did not change. What about mobility? Did mass education lead to more rapid turnover of winners and losers for a given skill hierarchy? According to the available data, the answer seems to be no. The intergenerational correlation of education and earned incomes, which measures the reproduction of the skill hierarchy over time, shows no trend toward greater mobility over the long run, and in recent years, mobility may even have decreased. Note, however, that it is much more difficult to measure mobility across generations than it is to measure inequality at a given point in time, and the sources available for estimating the historical evolution of mobility are highly imperfect. The most firmly established result in this area of research is that intergenerational reproduction is lowest in the Nordic countries and highest in the United States, with a correlation coefficient 2/3 higher than in Sweden. France, Germany, and Britain occupy a middle ground, less mobile than Northern Europe, but more mobile than the United States. These findings stand in sharp contrast to the belief in American exceptionalism that once dominated U.S. sociology, according to which social mobility in the United States was exceptionally high compared with the class-bound societies of Europe. No doubt the settler society of the early 19th century was more mobile. As I have shown, moreover, inherited wealth played a smaller role in the United States than in Europe, and U.S. wealth was for a long time less concentrated, at least up to World War I. Throughout most of the 20th century, however, and still today, the available data suggest that social mobility has been and remains lower in the United States than in Europe. One possible explanation for this is the fact that access to the most elite U.S. universities requires the payment of extremely high tuition fees. Furthermore, these fees rose sharply in the period 1990 to 2010, following fairly closely the increase in top U.S. incomes, which suggests that the reduced social mobility observed in the United States in the past will decline even more in the future. The issue of unequal access to higher education is increasingly a subject of debate in the United States. Research has shown that the proportion of college degrees earned by children whose parents belong to the bottom two quartiles of the income hierarchy stagnated at 10 to 20% in 1970 to 2010, while it rose